morning, members. I'm going to call the meeting to order. We don't have a quorum quite yet, so I will note it when we do have a quorum. But welcome some other folks today to our hearing. When we were originally doing our overview of PCA, there were a number of questions asked of Fish and Control Agency about the situation in the East Metro. And at that point, what we said is there are just too many questions, and why don't we ask the PCA to give us answers in writing, and then we will reconvene today at 8 and with those answers in hand. And I didn't know whether they'd bring up more questions or not, but as I was talking with folks, they wanted to hear from the health department because a new standard has now been set for PFOAs and PFOSs. And so folks wanted to hear about that new standard, and so I thought we would just have a quick overview of that before we get back to the Pollution Control Agency. Welcome to the committee, and if you would please put your name on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Langstein. I'm the Director of Environmental Health Division for the Minnesota Department of Health. And joining me today is Dr. Helen Gaden, a toxicologist who works for our division, as well as an assistant commissioner, Dr. Norman Crouch, seated in the back of the room here, and Dr. Crouch is available if questions come up. His particular expertise is in laboratory analysis and the work of the public health labs. What I will do is just briefly introduce the subject, as you've done already, Madam Chair, that we've been working over the past several years with Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and communities of Lake Elmo and Oakdale, which that investigation led us to look further south into other communities in Washington County, and that, as a result, led us to find additional groundwater contamination in parts of southern Washington County, northern Dakota County, that is now the subject of an ongoing investigation between the Department of Health and Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, as well as the affected communities. Specifically, Madam Chair, we would like to give you the briefing and the overview of the updated health-based values that we released last week on Thursday, and I believe you got a copy of our press release, and so I'll ask Dr. Gaden to make a statement and to give you background and context for that change.
Thank you. I'd first like to start with just a very brief explanation of what health-based values are and how we develop them. They represent the concentration of a substance in groundwater that can be consumed daily for up to a lifetime with little or no risk to health. The concentration is a function of how toxic a substance is and how much you consume of that substance in contaminated water. A reference dose is a measure of the toxicity potential, and this dose represents a dose at which harmful health effects are not anticipated, even in sensitive populations. The Department of Health utilizes intake rates for high-end consumers along with this reference dose to ensure that the health-based value that's developed will be protective of individuals who consume a large percentage of their water from a given source. Now, for the development of the PFOS and PFOA numbers, we reviewed the available toxicity information and identified studies that identified sensitive effects at low levels, and these are identified as critical studies for the development of a reference dose for those chemicals. The effects identified for PFOS were decreased serum levels of cholesterol and T3, which is a thyroid hormone, and the effects that were identified for PFOA was increased liver weight. Now, these low effect dose levels were divided by an adjustment factor to account for the fact that the half-life of these chemicals is much longer in humans than it was in the laboratory species that was utilized for the study. This adjustment factor was a factor of 20 for PFOS and a factor of 70 for PFOA. The next step was then to take this adjusted dose and divide it further by factors of 100 for PFOS and 300 for PFOA to account for several areas where we did not have complete information. Now, the intake rate that was selected to go along with the revised reference doses for each of these chemicals was a high-end consumption rate that incorporated accumulation in the body as well as the higher intake rates early in life. Now, to ensure that total exposure from other potential sources of exposure other than drinking water, we also applied what is known as a relative source contribution factor, and this resulted in a further reduction of about a five-fold factor. This calculation resulted in health-based values of 0.3 micrograms per liter for PFAS and 0.5 micrograms per liter for PFOA. Now, to ensure that these values were adequately protective of developing fetuses and infants, we also took a very close look at the developmental effects that have been reported for these chemicals. Now, in the case of PFAS, the developmental effects that have been reported typically occur at doses that are 3 to 7 times higher than the liver and the critical effects that we base the reference dose on. Whereas for PFOA, the developmental effects typically occurred at levels that were similar to the dose that was used to develop the reference value. We developed or estimated possible health-based values based on developmental effects using two different types of evaluations. One was protection of the developing fetus by ensuring that long-term exposure to the mother would not result in an accumulated dose that would pose a risk. And the second evaluation was to assess a basically bottle-fed infant that would be having high intake water levels. Neither one of these estimated health-based values resulted in a lower value than the one that was based on the critical studies that we selected.
Let me just follow up for a couple of questions here. So you, when you used your intake rate, you used the specific intake rate for 0 to 6 months?
For the infant evaluation, yes.
Okay. Then let me ask, New Jersey just came out with a new standard, and theirs is 0.04 in contrast to ours, which is 0.5. which makes theirs substantially more protective of New Jersey residents. I think I've done the math and say it's about 10 times more protective, but I want you to help me out there and see if I'm right about that.
The number is approximately an order of magnitude. There are values that have also been developed by other scientific groups. EPA and Germany have also developed numbers. And so there's a range of numbers that are out there. New Jersey's is the lowest value, yes.
And am I right that it's about 10 times more protective than the Minnesota rate?
The value is about 10 times lower than the Minnesota value.
Madam Chair, I think what I'm hearing you say is you're asking if it's more protective.
Yes.
Rather than just the difference numerically in the values. There are some differences in the toxicological information that New Jersey relied upon to develop their information as compared to the information that the Department of Health in Minnesota used. And perhaps I could ask Dr. Gayden to characterize the differences between the New Jersey studies that were used and approaches that they took as compared to the approach that we took, if that might help you.
Yes, I think that would be helpful.
Thank you.
The value that New Jersey came up with was based on basically female rats. And the female rat has an extremely quick elimination rate of this chemical, and so you'll see episodic variations in the blood level. The New Jersey Department of Protection basically extrapolated from a modeled blood level in the female rat to a level for humans. We had some concerns about the modeled value that was developed by EPA. Since the blood level was based on a different study, the modeling was based on a different study for a different purpose, and they basically estimated blood levels that could have occurred in this particular study. We were not comfortable with using that kind of an extrapolation. And we did not feel that the female rat was the most appropriate animal model for humans. We used the non-human primate studies, which New Jersey also evaluated. They did a range of evaluations as well.
It looked to me like what New Jersey was doing was saying, this is the amount that's of PFOAs that is found in a person's blood. And on average, I think EPA says it's about 5 parts per billion. And that's an EPA number. Is that a number you agree with, that that's an average?
For the general population, that's been published, yes.
Okay. And how does that, your number of 0.5 parts, or, yeah, 0.5 parts per billion relate to that number?
To the human?
The average. with the average. Oh, it looked to me like in the Emmett study that folks in Minnesota using our rate would end up with just what's average in Americans. Is that about right?
Based on the information that Emma published, he looked at a ratio of what was gets to the water to serum level, was basically a ratio of about 1 to 100.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, if you could use that ratio and say if the water concentration is 0.5, you can extrapolate and estimate what a potential human blood level would be. I don't know how accurate that would be.
But it is something to think about, that
yes.
That's what our standard ends up being, and our standard would end up being the average. If Emmett was right, and the way he did his study, we'd end up having, well, our outcome would be what's average in the American population. Representative Hansen, I saw I had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Stein and Dr. Gayden. First off, Mr. Stein, thank you for coming around to our communities, and I attended the session in South St. Paul, and your staff were very professional at that, and I appreciate that. What I've been struggling with here is the data and the methodology and time, and looking at how much, you know, we have data on PFOS and PFOA that I'm assuming that, I mean, we see documents in front of us that are recent within the last week or two, and we see, you know, decisions being made around the country that appear to be within a weekly time period rather than over a period of years. And to go to PFBA, it appears that the detection methodology for water is only a year or 2 years old. So my first question is just how much, when we look at the science here and the confidence in the methodology and the time of reproducibility of data, and I mean, what are we looking at here for the confidence in the data that we have on setting these limits? It appears to be all very recent, and new data leads to new decisions and new changes on these limits.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, thank you for the compliment, first of all. And secondly, you're correct that these chemical compounds are of very intense interest scientifically, both in public agencies as well as in the industrial chemical community that's out there. And there's a significant body of research activity ongoing at the present time. That being said, the nature of decisions that are used to establish health-based numbers, whether those be health-based values, rely upon the emerging technology, which, as you say, we at Public Health Lab in this state just recently developed the protocol and methodology to be able to reliably sample and test for other members of the perfluorochemical family of compounds. It does and will continue to emerge, I would say, very rapidly. There is a significant amount of research ongoing at the present time, and it certainly is plausible to think that additional research will be conducted because of the intense scientific interest in these compounds. We do expect additional toxicological research to be available in the next year on the compound you mentioned, which is perfluorobutanoic acid, referred to as PFBA. We're aware of ongoing studies, and we expect somewhere late during this calendar year to have additional evidence or data from those studies that might help us understand toxicity a little better. It would be premature to think that we'll have sufficient data to make a toxicological determination probably prior to the end of this year, however.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
So with that being said, if we always need more data. It appears that this data is relatively recent. I think you're familiar with the precautionary principle, and that if we don't have a lot of data, and we as policymakers have to make decisions based on the limited data we have, then it would be our best interest to represent our constituents and make decisions based on trying to be precautionary and look at the data that we have. What troubles me with this rapidly evolving data set that we have and the methodology, if we've only been able to detect PFBA in water for a year and a half, you know, looking at tissue, looking at blood, looking at long-term chronological data, we don't have the data set that's there, and to wait for the data set to be there may not be wise. So I realize there's more data on PFOS and PFOA, and there's perhaps a greater threat there. But I guess I'd like something more just on your confidence on data, or if you have an understanding of our needs as legislators in responding to public concern.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I do appreciate the dilemma of having limited data, and also the challenge that we heard in all of the communities we visited, which is people interested in knowing what our opinion is, or our perspective is on safe levels of PFBA in drinking water. At this point, we have used one part per billion as the value at which we say below that there is no risk associated with drinking water with that concentration of PFBA. Above that level, we are giving advice to property owners to help them make informed decisions. I think the second part of your question gets to the debate between information about health impacts and then response actions and potential for the response to occur in terms of interventions in drinking water systems, both in private homes that are served by private wells as well as those that are supplied by municipal water systems. So there is, at this point, no health-based value that we've established for PFBA. We hope that we will be in a better position to do that late this year. And I understand that puts a very difficult position for decision makers at a policy level, both in communities as well as this body of the legislature. So I do appreciate that. Unfortunately, it's premature from a science-based standpoint to give any more confidence around an upper limit, so to speak, at this time.
One final follow-up. Madam Chair, I'm assuming you're probably having a lot of staff working on this. It's a great deal of interest for the public, and there's probably some folks working in the area. I would ask you to make sure you're keeping track of your time. And, you know, I know that the public meetings had a cost to them, and I think that, you know, rather than the general fund paying for these things, we should look at making sure there's some reimbursement for cost, as there is with maybe some of the other agencies. So I would hope the health department would be tracking that as we move forward.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we are.
Representative Bingham. Thank you. And Mr. Stein, and I forget the last name, I'm sorry, Dr.
Gayden.
Thank you. First off, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the numerous meetings. I was at three of them, and just appreciate the time that you and your staff put into them. I have two questions. At the community meeting, there were a lot of concerns from constituents regarding the long-term effects on exposure to from this chemical on expecting women and children. And also, there was questions regarding tests currently being done. Simple yes or no question, are the tests being done to develop some numbers on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, I'll ask Dr. Gayden to respond to the ongoing research that's being conducted relative to developmental effects of perfluorochemicals.
Okay. I assume you're speaking about PFBA specifically?
Yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, PFBA. Well, actually, any of it. If you are doing tests on the other ones, that you can answer that, but PFBA.
There are ongoing, particularly developmental studies for PFOA. And those are some of the studies that John had indicated. Hopefully we'll have more information later this year. We do have, obviously, quite a bit of developmental information on these chemicals already. For PFBA, that was one of the studies we did request be conducted. It was a developmental study. And we specifically requested it to be done in mice because that was felt to be a better animal model for developmental endpoints. We have preliminary information from the investigator, who is actually an EPA researcher who's an expert in developmental toxicity. The preliminary information indicates that there was no effect even at the highest dose that they evaluated, which was substantially higher than the doses used for PFOA or PFOS. They did not see effects on body weight or survivability, those sorts of things, which had been seen for the other two chemicals. But I don't have information about some of the other parameters that they're evaluating as the offspring grow. But the preliminary information suggests that it is not as toxic as the other two chemicals.
Well, that's important because it was a bit, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. That's important because it was a reoccurring question that came. So
yes, I can understand that. Yes.
The other question I have is that Mr. Stein, you just had mentioned that you'd set an advisory level of one part per billion, and that if it's over one, if for PFBA, and if it's over one part per billion, you advise residents to take precautionary measures. Do you have any comments about when in St. Paul Park it's two parts per billion, which is double the limit of what you set? I mean, at some point I would assume you would want to take action when it exceeds the limit, and that's my concern, and I know that's what you heard at the community meeting. So I guess I'd like you to expand on how come when the guidelines are set, that you set the guidelines at one part per billion, St. Paul Park and many of the wells in Cottage Grove are over one part per billion, that no action from the department has been taken to ask the faulty party here to do bottled water or filters.
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, as Dr. Gayden earlier presented, the methodology that's used to develop a health-based value involves a series of numerical values and assumptions of uncertainty that are applied in a formula that is published in our rule, and those formulas then develop a dose or a concentration in drinking water at which it is determined to be safe over a lifetime of consumption as Dr. Gayden mentioned, at a significant intake rate. So when you see a number such as we see in St. Paul Park, that's twice what we're giving the advice to homeowners about. It's a little bit misleading to characterize it as double that effect, because what we're characterizing at one part per billion is no effect. Then to say that it's twice that level, to then translate that to twice that effect, is not necessarily the best way to characterize that level. That's why when we're quoted on this, we say there's really no bright line on this chemical compound at this time. So even though it's double the level, it's an unfair characterization to say it's twice that level of an effect. And perhaps Dr. Gayden could comment to illuminate further from a more scientific standpoint.
I'm not sure if I can. John is absolutely correct that the values that we develop typically for health-based values that we numerically calculate, there is a fairly large margin of safety in terms of between those and when you would expect a health effect to occur. the one part per billion is not a calculated health-based value. It's a guideline value that we, given the information we currently have, feel that it would not be associated with health effects. But we can't, since we don't have sufficient scientific information, we can't tell you at what point would you anticipate health effects.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But as Representative Hansen pointed out, until you have that scientific information, why not take precautionary measures on this? And I don't care if the levels, you know, it doesn't make me feel any better that it's double your advisory level, you know, double the effects. I don't know, reminds me of the double mint gum commercial. But the fact is that no level is acceptable, in my opinion. And the other fact is that when you set a guideline and it's over, I mean, precautionary measures should be taken until you have that scientific information. And I understand that you're doing 20-day studies, 90-day studies, and we're appreciative of that because nobody, you know, you want to have the concrete scientific information here. But on the other side, it doesn't do justice when levels in many of the wells are over the advisory level that you set. So, I mean, again, I know that it was a different committee, but I'll say again is that when these levels are above what you ordered, I would ask that action be taken so that until you have the scientific information, my residents and the residents of Representative McNamara's district and the South St. Paul delegation's district are taken care of in Woodbury.
Representative Fun has a question.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and the two commissioners sign. My question has to do with the importance of the timeline involved here in terms of bringing further confidence about the scientific basis for setting a health-based value and also what the inputs into that decision will be. It was my understanding that in terms of, I'd like to hear a little more on what is planned in terms of having the types of additional input into that decision to try to complete that decision by the next year. My understanding that either it's underway or it's planned to do a 90-day study that is pretty much a follow-up to the 28-day study that Tufts College said it was already done. It's also my understanding that scientists don't really anticipate seeing anything new in that study, but it's going to be conducted. Is there anything other than the 90-day study that's going to be forthcoming that you expect to have as additional inputs into the decision, and what are those additional inputs going to be?
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, I'll ask Dr. Gayden to respond to what she's aware of as far as ongoing research.
In regard to PFBA, I'm not aware of additional research beyond the 90-day study. Obviously, the more information I could obtain, you know, the better, theoretically. But I'm not aware of any additional information or studies being planned. For PFOA, there are studies underway at EPA that I'm aware of, particularly in the area of developmental and latent effects from developmental exposure. There is also a neurodevelopmental study for PFOS that's being completed, and I believe EPA anticipates receiving that information in April sometime, but that is the research that I'm aware of.
Thank you, Chair. Let me follow up a little further. This is a very important question about, first of all, the types of input, when you expect to have them, how they affect your ability to set the health-based standard, and also the public trust in the inputs themselves, the research, and the evaluation of them, the methodology for doing that. So from what I hear from you, that all that's currently planned to be an additional input that's directly related to research on PFBA is the 90-day study. In addition to that, there's ongoing research on PFOAs, PFOSs, that we know because there's a relationship between PFBAs and those, it gives you some further insight into the PFBA as well. Are you going to be looking at both those two components, first of all, the new 90-day and the ongoing research? And in your estimation, within the next year or even shorter time period, is that all you will need to evaluate a health-based value for PFBA? And if not, what are you planning to do to get the information you need to establish that health-based value in a timely fashion?
Mm-hmm. I can't confirm that that would be enough. I mean, it depends on the results of the study. It is possible the study may raise questions rather in addition to answering some questions. So until we actually see the data, I would not be able to tell you whether it would be sufficient information or not.
And Madam Chair, to the second part of the question, Representative Bunn, we are currently working with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and 3M, who is likely the responsible party for the groundwater contamination, it would appear, in southern Washington County. We're working with them to identify needed research information that would assist in development of health-based values. We are also working closely with the Environmental Protection Agency and anticipate a workshop being held in the Twin Cities within the next 60 days to assist in bringing the relevant science that's available at from the EPA's perspective to the table and bringing their scientific experts to Minnesota to advise and to consult with the Minnesota Department of Health, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and others interested in this subject so that we can broaden what we all understand about ongoing activities and what other research might be useful so that that could be identified and labeled for such purpose. Because at the present time, we've had rather independent work on this going on here in Minnesota, certainly on PFBA, and we'd like to draw some more national interest in that from the Environmental Protection Agency in it. We have some commitments from their administrator's office that they are willing to assist.
Thank you, Chair. And just one last follow-up. First of all, if you can give us a date or timeline as to when you think you'll have the results on the 90-day study, because that appears to be very crucial to moving us towards a health-based standard from what your marks have said. And also, I just want to comment that I think it's very, I'm encouraged by your mentioning of the EPA workshop to be held here. I think crucial to us making progress legislatively in terms of protecting our public on this issue is that we broaden the net in terms of experts involved in this. I know that there aren't that many internationally on PFBA in particular, but that we have bring in people from the university, from Mayo, from outside Minnesota, from EPA, wherever, who are viewed as objective outsiders to this process to evaluate the work that's been done, to corroborate it, and to give the public and the legislature confidence in the final decision-making that occurs. Thank you.
Dr. Gooden, you mentioned some developmental studies that are going on, and Johns Hopkins just announced one of the studies that they're doing and finding decreased birth weight and head circumference among children. And when they were looking at the chemicals in the umbilical cord when they were starting their study, they found it in almost every case. Do you know that the amount that they are using as a or what they're finding and what they're finding first? Do you know the amount they're finding?
The amount of the chemicals in the
umbilical cord.
I don't have that information in front of me. My understanding from I did attend the presentation by Dr. Goldman, and my understanding is that the levels in the cord blood were not atypical of what they expected to find in the general public. So I anticipated they would be in the same range as what's already been published in terms of blood levels for the general public.
So would your standard that you are proposing mean that there would be less of the chemicals in blood cord than are showing preliminarily showing effects at Johns Hopkins?
I do not have sufficient information to predict a human blood level from our current health-based value. It would depend on a lot of different factors in terms of the amount of water individuals drank, how quickly they eliminated the chemicals individually, what other potential sources of exposure to this chemical they have. I don't feel confident that I could predict what the blood level would be.
I mean, I think that's a critical question, though, for all of us, because Johns Hopkins is finding that, yes, it appears that there is a relationship between the development of the child and what is in the blood level, and that if that is the practical outcome, then our practical response needs to be to reduce the average. So that's my concern here, and I don't think we're getting an answer to that. I mean, you apparently don't have an answer to that question, but that would be a question that I would hope you would answer to us in writing, and we can certainly share it among members. And any of the other questions that Dr. Bunn asked, if you could share those with us, and we certainly do get it out to members. I think there are two other questions, Representative Doty and then Representative McNamara. We need to move on to PCA.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Gayden, did I understand you correctly earlier that the half-life of these chemicals in humans is, did you say, 20 to 70 times the length of the lab animals?
Yes.
Would you put that in real time for us? What would the half-life be in hours or days or months or years in humans?
The half-life for that's been estimated for humans for PFAS is, I believe, 5.4 years, and for PFOA, 3.8 years.
Is, Madam Chair, is a 90-day study sufficient to show the cumulative effect of a chemical with a half-life of 3 to 5 years?
Yes, because the half-life in the laboratory species that are being used is much shorter, so it will accumulate to levels and reach what's referred to as a steady state within, as long as the study is of sufficient duration. And since we know the relationship between the half-life in that species and humans, we can then estimate what an equivalent accumulation would be in humans. It would take longer, obviously, but that's why there's that adjustment of a factor of 20-fold or 70-fold. At the same dose rate, let's say in the non-human primates, if their half-life is 20-fold lower, that's why we would lower the dose, equivalent dose in humans by 20-fold to account for the fact that humans have a 20-fold higher ability to accumulate this chemical. That's why that specific adjustment is made to account for that.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, most of my questions are around 3M and looking forward to 3M testifying because they have not been publicly before any of the public meetings that we've been at so far. So I really look forward to that testimony. And actually, my questions for Mr. Stein kind of center around most of 3M, so I can confirm. I want to ask some of the questions that I see 3M is going to present shortly with some information. Specifically, Mr. Stein, you and I have had a number of discussions, and I gave out some wrong information originally in what 3M has paid in Oakdale. Is it about $2.5 million that 3M paid in Oakdale to fix the wells in Oakdale?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, yes. My understanding is this grant of approximately $2.5 million to assist the city of Oakdale constructing a water treatment system, a large activated carbon treatment plant for two of their wells.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize to some of the members of my community when Mr. Stein and I had some miscommunication, and originally I was told it was $10 million. So I apologize for anybody that thought it cost $10 million to fix what really only cost $2.5 million. My next question is, in the area of Lake Elmo, I believe it was in the $4 to $5 million range to fix that situation. And again, did we expect 3M, and did 3M pay that?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, yes, and I apologize that I gave you some incorrect information up front, so that I don't want you to feel responsible for my misleading information either, so I apologize.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Stein, you've been a terrific addition to MPCA and a real loss for the DNR when you moved over. I'm sorry, the Department of Health. I don't want to get you over to MPCA.
I don't know if that's good news or bad news yet, but thanks. Thanks anyway.
Well, Madam Chair, just where I really want to cut to the chase you have lowered the standards in Lake Elmo, and there are a number of people in Lake Elmo that now fit in the standard. Is there any reason for us to believe that 3M is not going to step up and take care of those people's wells? And are you going to pursue to have 3M pay for those wells that those standards now are in that range?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, yes, we have consulted with the PCA and started the process of identifying any wells, any private wells, that are above the new health-based values. I don't know yet if there are any wells that have been identified. It looks as though there may be very few, if any, that have brought in to this into the fold, so to speak, of treated water as a result of lowering our health-based values. But that being said, my understanding is that all of the actions necessary to provide safe water in Lake Elmo and Oakdale for systems that exceed the health-based values will be dealt with through the Pollution Control Agency under their responsibilities for Superfund or the closed landfill program.
Madam Chair and Mr. Stein, so is the answer that you will pursue to have 3M pay for that?
Yes, that's the process that's used under Superfund.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Stein. I have one more real quick question in regards to, we have some information before us that 3M is going to present that talks about the need to drink hundreds of thousands of water to reach the level that the rats were exposed to. Are you consistent and believe when 3M comes forward? I just want to confirm while you're at the testifying table. Have you been aware of this information, and do you have any reason to believe it's untrue?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I'm going to answer that slightly differently. There's a continuum of interpretation of the scientific data that's available. As the Chair noted earlier, New Jersey interpreted sets of data to produce a value that was 0.4 micrograms per liter parts per billion. We have looked at similar studies and data and concluded differently. Other states and other governmental entities around the world have the same set of data that they use, and there is a continuum of values that people arrive at in terms of health-based and levels that are safe to drink. Our approach is protective of public health. It is protective of components of the subpopulations that might be sensitive because of higher intake rates or particular sensitivities, and we believe as we work on these issues that's the approach we take. Others may take other views looking at it from different perspectives, and I'm not going to comment on whether or not any other interpretations are valid. Our interpretations are based on protection for public health.
We can have one more question, and that's Representative Swales.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for inviting me to the committee today. I am the representative from Woodbury and deeply appreciate the informational session that was attended by about 400 of my constituents. I really do believe that the Minnesota Department of Health and the PCA and the representative who also was there discussing the Superfund were very, very helpful. And like Representative McNamara, I'm very anxious to hear the people from 3M. I do have a couple of specific questions that I think are related to you, and then I would really love to get into the rest of the testimony. But who is paying for the test? Is that the Public Health Department's budget?
Madam Chair, Representative Swales, yes. At this time, there's actually a variety of sources of funds being used to sample and analyze the water that are occurring. The staff time and some of the services that the Minnesota Department of Health provides generally come out of general fund sources, out of our division's budget. Minnesota Pollution Control Agency staff are also working very diligently on this issue, and their costs, I might have them comment on, but my understanding is they pay some of those costs out of the remediation fund, and then they can seek cost recovery for some of those those dollars through through their authorities.
And I understand, I understand that each test is around $380 or so. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, the cost to run the suite of perfluoro compounds through our public health laboratory is currently between $300 and $400.
All right. Just one more question, Madam Chair. I had a constituent who attended the meeting at the Woodbury Lutheran Church, and she's very upset. She has health issues, and she has a private well. I understand there are over 300 private wells in Woodbury. She was told at that time that it's going to cost $800 to have her well tested with an additional $200 fee, which is beyond her means of being able to pay. What do I tell my constituents who are concerned and very much want to be safe and to feel safe, and the best way they know to feel safe is to know that their drinking water has been tested and has been found so?
Madam Chair, Representative Swales, what we talk to similar individuals, and I'm sure we've spoken with this constituent of yours as well.
I'm sure you have.
The we are doing with assistance of Pollution Control Agency staff and sampling of various aquifers throughout the South Washington County communities. We're looking at aquifers that from near surface to the Franconia Iron and Galesville aquifer, which is several hundred feet below the surface of the ground. We are characterizing contamination in the various aquifers, and what we try to work with homeowners who are questioning, should I have a water sample paid for? The reason that the sample costs that she was quoted were so high is because it's not possible for a private landowner to submit a sample to the public health lab for analysis. Those are for public purposes, and private sampling is handled by private labs, and the private lab costs are higher than the public health lab costs are in the state. What I tell folks is we can give you a range that we're fairly comfortable understanding what we've seen in the sampling that we've conducted. If we know enough about the aquifer, we can give you a range of values that we believe your water will be in. We can give you some health-based advice about that information, what we think might be prudent if you're interested in lowering exposure. It's probably an unwise expenditure at this time for people to go out and sample their well and have that analysis, because all that will tell them is what the specific concentration is. And until we can give them better advice, if it's PFBA that we're worried about, it's probably not the best way for them to spend their money at this time.
Thanks for coming. We spent far more time on this than I expected we do, and we have folks that have come from out of town to talk about our next issue coming up. But I know that 3M is here. They have put a sheet on the table. So if they have something to say in addition to this, we'd be glad to have them. I am very cognizant of the time, because we are going to hear from the folks who come from the Minnesota Conservation Corps. Thank you. And if someone from 3M would like to give remarks in addition to what you've handed out, I don't think it's necessary to repeat what's on the sheet you handed out. Yes, if you would like to give us your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Dr. Kathy Reed, and I'm the Vice President of 3M's Environmental Health and Safety Operations. With me today is Dr. Larry Zobel, 3M Staff Vice President and Medical Director. Larry Zobel is a physician and public health professional, and also Mr. Mike Santoro, who is our Director of Regulatory Affairs, and his background is in chemistry and environmental engineering. Madam Chair and members of the committee, we appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. We understand that you may have many questions about the presence of fluorochemicals in the Southeast Metro area, and we thought it would be helpful to take a couple of minutes to provide a very brief history of 3M's experience with these chemicals and our ongoing efforts to address the presence of PFPA in drinking water in the Southeast Metro. First, I'd like to say that 3M has a history of environmental responsibility, which includes being a global leader in reducing the environmental impacts from our manufacturing. Many of our corporate programs have served as the model for other organizations, and our work has been recognized at the federal and state levels, including Minnesota. 3M's commitment to environmental leadership is ongoing, and you can count on the company to responsibly address the issue of PFBA in drinking water. In the state of Minnesota, our history is one of acting responsibly and working with and at the direction of the MPCA and other regulatory agencies. Finding solutions that address environmental issues has always been a high priority of 3M. We take pride that our work with the MPCA since the agency was established has been consistently professional, respectful, and cooperative. Relative to PFOA and PFOS, we have been actively engaged with the MPCA by supplying information about our historical manufacture and disposal of the materials. Beyond supplying information and data, the MPCA and State of Minnesota can count on 3M to work cooperatively to address the presence of PFOS, PFOA, and PFBA in the environment. Recent news reports have treated all PFCs as very similar materials. They are, in fact, very different. For instance, PFBA is substantially different from PFOS and PFOA, both chemically and toxicologically. PFBA, as you've heard from the Department of Health, has significantly lower toxicity in animal testing. It has shown no developmental effects in animal testing, and in laboratory tests, it clears the body much faster than PFOA. Even though these materials are very different, we do know based on science that there are no health effects from PFBA, PFOA, or PFOS at the levels found in the environment. This is based on decades of research involving monitoring our production employees and laboratory studies of PFOS and PFOA, and more recent research involving PFBA. About that research, if some news reports of laboratory observations from animal tests on these materials have implied human health effects. However, the objective of a laboratory study is to determine if there are biological effects and how much it takes to produce that effect. The concept of dose is critical. For PFBA, in the most recent animal study, to reach the level of exposure that caused the first reported effect, an adult weighing 110 pounds would need to consume more than 500,000 8-ounce glasses of water per day that contained one part per billion of PFBA. Even though these trace levels of PFBA do not pose a health risk, 3M is taking this matter very seriously. We're conducting the following work to identify potential sources and to determine whether additional containment measures are appropriate. We are sponsoring additional laboratory research and environmental studies. We are engaging independent experts. We are identifying potential sources of PFBA at our former disposal sites. We're conducting additional groundwater monitoring and installing new monitoring wells, and we're expanding our hydrogeological investigation. The work is well underway, and we anticipate significant progress over the next few months. As you would expect, 3M remains committed to working with the MPCA, the state of Minnesota, and the local communities in this matter. Thanks for the opportunity to address this committee. We're happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative McNamara, you indicated you had some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Reed, I really want to say thank you for coming forward. I think it's important. I've advocated from day one that 3M step forward and let us know, and I'm really glad that you're here, and it's on public tape, and we've heard you say, and I just want to confirm, and Dr. Zobel, you've met with me a couple of different times. I appreciate that because I have real concern. I want to confirm, Dr. Reed, just very simply, that you have said that PFBA in the levels that we're talking about do not have any health effects. And then I want to confirm, did you say that, Dr. Reed?
Yes, I did.
Thank you, Dr. Reed. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Reed, I want to follow up one more. You don't look... I apologize if this offends you. You don't look old enough to have grandchildren, so I'm going to say it would be your daughter. If you had a young daughter living in St. Paul Park at a level of 2.3 parts per billion, would you recommend to that daughter that they drink through a Brita or a pure filter, or would you drink it right out of the tap?
Well, thanks for the compliment on my age. I'm capable of having grandchildren at this age. I have absolutely no concerns about drinking the public drinking water in any of the communities that we've been discussing. And I want to also mention my background is in biochemistry and chemistry, and I'll ask Dr. Zobel also to comment. But the drinking water is safe to drink from the perspective of the levels of PFOS, PFOA, and PFBA in the community drinking water supply.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Reed, I'm going to ask you again. I've already asked Dr. Zobel, and I'm going to ask him on the tape because I know what he's already said. I asked him in my office. If you had a young granddaughter and you're living in the city of St. Paul Park where the level is 2.3 PFBA, I'm not talking about the level of arsenic or whatever else might be in the water, would you recommend that they drink water through a filter or drink bottled water? If your daughter was breastfeeding your grandchild, would you recommend that they buy a Brita filter?
No, I would not.
Thank you, Dr. Reed. Dr. Zobel, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Zobel, I'm going to ask you the same question. If you have a granddaughter, your daughter, I think you told me that you have children that were thinking about maybe moving to Hastings. Thank you. I could use more constituents. If you had a granddaughter or a daughter, let's say, that was nursing a grandchild in Hastings or St. Paul Park, I want to pick on Representative Bigham's community because they have the highest level. I want to know if you would recommend that they drink bottled water or drink out of a pure water filter, Brita filter, Dr. Zobel.
Representative, Madam Chair, I would have no hesitation at all to recommend use of the city water in any of these communities.
Thank you, Dr. Zobel. And I want to confirm, Madam Chair, Dr. Zobel, you're a medical doctor. Is that true?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, Madam Chair, I have a couple other questions. I'm going to go really quick. Dr. Reed, see, you know, I see you're a vice president, so you're a lot higher up the chain, and you're the kind of person I want to talk to. If we find out for some reason that PFBA is more serious and you're studying it in rats or mice or whatever you're studying in it, I appreciate that. Keep spending lots of money on this issue because it's very important. And I come from a family who had three uncles spend their career working at 3M Chemolite plant, and we've got second generation folks living in Hastings. I want to know for sure if we find out that PFBA is serious and you need to spend millions on the water systems, or we need to spend millions in either St. Paul Park, Cottage Grove, or Hastings, are you going to step forward in your own hometown like you did in Oakdale and Lake Elmo? And I want to know absolutely what you'll do.
I can tell you with confidence that we expect the HPV developed for PFBA to be significantly higher than the currently very, very precautionary level of 1. However, in some event, if an HPV were derived using a standard methodology and it turned out to be an issue, we would step up as we have in a very responsible way. We take responsibility for our materials. So if an HPV or preferably an HRL were developed and at one point the city water supply were above that, you can count on 3M.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, one last question. Dr. Reed, how many people are between you and the chairman of the board of 3M? How many steps up the ladder are between you and that person?
There is one person between me and our chairman of the board.
Madam Chair and Dr. Reed, do you ever have direct conversation with the chairman of the board of 3M, and would you have access to him about this issue, or he, she, I'm sorry, I don't know who the chair of 3M is.
Yes, I would if it became necessary.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming in to testify today. A couple things. In the reading or the materials that you provided, and this was talked about in the community meetings, this chemical was dumped in the 1950s and 60s, correct?
Which chemical?
The at the disposal site, the PFBA and, yeah, PFBA. I was thinking the PFOAs too, but the chemical, right?
That's our assumption. We didn't learn about PFBA until the last year.
Yeah, last year. Do you have any idea or any studies that would indicate when it got into the water? Just out of curiosity.
That's hard to say, and in a moment I'll ask Santoro to step in. We stopped disposing of our materials in these areas more than 30 years ago, and the two areas that we had responsibility for, the Oakdale site and the Woodbury site, were the subject of an MPCA remediation action that 3M sponsored. And in those areas, there was a material that was a conventional organic, and those materials occurred in the same areas as the fluorochemicals. At the time that we did the original remediation, it was not possible analytically to identify specific fluorochemicals or get to those very low detection limits. That only became possible in the late 1990s. What we do know is that for the Oakdale site, there was a close-by municipal well.
Yeah.
As a part of our remediation, we decided to close that well and sponsor the drilling of a new well. But in fact, at the time of the remediation, there were no chemicals found in that well. So we do know that piece of information from that point in time. Similarly, at the Woodbury landfill, we monitored the groundwater for the conventional materials and developed a pump-out system which draws water to the site so that rather than groundwater flowing away, groundwater is drawn to the site and it is removed as a containment measure.
A couple follow-ups, Madam Chair. There were numerous, I'm sorry, Representative Hathbart, you're kind of getting in the line of fire thing.
Gunther.
There were numerous community meetings. As Representative Swale said, there were 400 in Woodbury. There's, I'd say, at least 250 in Cottage Grove. And I mean, it was well attended. Would you care to comment on why no representatives from 3M were there?
We consider that communication to be the responsibility of the health department, and we have confidence that they will address public health issues in an appropriate way.
Okay. I'm going to do a little statement and then maybe end with a question, but you know, this has affected the community in a big way, whether it's been health-based concerns or that's majority of the concerns, but also from an economic point of view, that this is a big concern for resale and for development in these cities to diversify the tax bases for our communities. So I guess I can't reiterate that enough from my local government officials and from my constituents. The other thing is, you know, St. Paul Park is, you know, as Representative McNamara said, over two parts per billion for PFBA, and many of Cottage Grove's 11 wells are over one part per billion. Why not, until we have the science? Why not just do what's right and put people on water and filtration system?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's really important to understand that there is a fair amount of science, and I'll ask Dr. Zobel to comment on those studies. The truth is the water is safe to drink now.
Yeah, Representative Madam Chair, I guess two responses. The water is safe to drink as it currently exists, and supplying an alternative supply, I believe, sends the wrong message.
Okay, one last concern. Everything that's in here talks about 90-day or 28-day study. There is nothing in here that talks about long-term studies for somebody like myself who's been a resident of Cottage Grove for 27 years and have been drinking this at a consistent base. So I have a lot of constituents that are very concerned about the long-term repeated consumption of this water and for expecting women and children. And now I'm done for the respect of the committee. Thank you.
Representative Hanson, you'll have the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Reed, I think you'd heard my questions earlier. And I want to focus on one paragraph in the fact sheet here on the monitoring of health of the production employees. And I'm assuming that, you know, many companies have biomonitoring where the employees who have the day-to-day exposure working with the product may have blood samples analyzed, etc. Does 3M, do you have a biomonitoring program for those employees who were handling this material day in, day out?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we do, and I'll ask Dr. Zobel to comment on
that. The biomonitoring that we've done in our employees has been primarily for PFOA and PFOS, and that started specifically for those materials in the early 90s. There was a more general test done before that. We never did monitor specifically for PFBA. Now, very recently, we've undertaken a program to ask employees permission to retest some stored blood that we have for PFBA, and that's underway right now.
And just to follow up, so I mean, is there any continuing research long-term, maybe after they leave employment? Is there an opportunity for, I mean, it would seem that with the short data set of material that the long-term data would be the folks that have had direct acute exposure over a period of time. And just to follow up on that specifically, that the detection methodology for PFBA being relatively short, is it possible to, you know, you mentioned that you're working with those folks, just, again, looking at the net of data to try to get good data in a relatively quick period of time, asking the employees or former employees permission, if you can just give an idea of what's happening there.
Yeah, Representative, we are trying to find ways to assess whether we have any human exposure in manufacturing to PFBA, and are attempting to, if that's done, we would then do some sort of health monitoring program. But to date, it's hard to find people who have definitely been exposed to this compound in the occupational setting.
Thank you. I do see that Representative Mullen had a question that I missed, and I'm going to ask him. But before I go on to that, you talked about how much monitoring you've done of your employees. Have you ever monitored the offspring of your employees?
Madam Chair, yes. A study done by Dr. Alexander at the University of Minnesota did follow up all of the individuals who had ever worked at our Alabama plant. And in that study, we found, we asked questions about birth weight, which is one of the parameters that is typically remembered with birth precision by people. And in that study, there were no differences in birth weight between women who had been in jobs that were highly exposed to PFOS or PFOA and those in jobs that had no direct exposure to PFOS and PFOA. And there were approximately 30 to 40 births, I don't remember the exact number, among women who had worked in highly exposed jobs. Additionally, we've been able to look at medical claims for reproductive outcomes and have found no difference between people working in the chemical division and people working in another type of manufacturing on the same site.
Your studies are different than the ones done by Johns Hopkins, which actually precisely measured birth weight, found that there was not a lot of change, but the change was significant, and head circumference, and apparently you didn't do that. Representative Mo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this would be, my question would be for either Ms. Reed or Dr. Zobel, I'm not sure which. Just a more basic question. I'm reading the materials that you pointed out to us here, and that based on science, there are no risks from PFBA, PFOA, and PFOS at the levels found in the environment. This is based on decades of research, et cetera. And this seems really strange to me. If there are, in fact, no risks whatsoever for the amount of these chemicals that are in the environment currently, why are you even working on this subject? what is bringing you to the table now? What is your concern if, in fact, this is not dangerous to Minnesotans whatsoever? And then my follow-up question would be, should you acknowledge, if you were to acknowledge in this information that you were to hand out to us, that, in fact, there were health ramifications or risks, how would that impact the liability of 3M in this case?
I think we should both respond to this. I spent 20 years in our division in the R&D setting, and as a practice, we believe it is 3M's responsibility to know and understand the effects of its chemicals on its production workers. So the work that we had initiated around human health primarily had to do with our employees starting back in the 60s and 70s. Since that time, when it became clear that widespread presence of PFOS and PFOA indicated that people were exposed who had not worked in our areas or been using our products, the work was expanded, and Dr. Zobel can cover that.
Yes, the work has been simply done to properly characterize risk for those people exposed at the population level. Exposure in the occupational setting is considered different. We have healthy people at work. The population in general includes a wide range of people, from elderly to young to disabled, to a wide range of susceptibilities to the things that you generally don't find in the workplace. So we have done a significant, dozens to hundreds of studies probably to try to properly characterize risk at environmental levels.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up. Dr. Reed, excuse me. You said, though, that you hear that you just learned of the contamination of PFBA last year. Correct? I mean, didn't you just say that you only were aware of the level of contamination more recently? These long-term studies, I'm not sure that really applies, frankly.
We were surprised when the Department of Health shared with us information that they had developed a special test and found PFBA in some drinking water. As a result of that, I believe it was last June, we met with the Department of Health and agreed immediately to do a 28-day TOP study, and I'll ask Dr. Zobel to comment on that.
Let me say that in terms of interpreting, being able to interpret from the short term to the long term, you want to look at several different factors. One is our knowledge in general of the fluorochemical toxicology. We know that chain length, for example, has a great deal to do with it. The longer molecules are more toxic. When you get into shorter lengths like PFBA, they generally have less toxicity. They stay in the body for a less length of time. A 28-day study, the findings in the 28-day study, the mechanisms by which those findings occurred are things that all the findings typically show up in the first 5 to 7 days, actually, of exposure. We'll learn in a 90-day study whether any other mechanisms of toxicity are evident, and from there we can make a judgment as to whether or not a longer-term study is appropriate to do in the laboratory setting. From current evidence, and based on what we know about other fluorochemicals, characterize, I think, the general toxicology of the shorter chain fluorochemicals like PFBA as significantly less toxic than the longer chain. And the 28-day study tends to confirm that, as does the developmental study being done at EPA and further laboratory studies of mechanisms that are done in some academic settings.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. We appreciate it. This is going on longer than I really want. However, I know this is extraordinarily important to our communities. If PCA would come up, I think we can chat very, very quickly. You have, I don't know who's representing Pollution Control Agency. Is it Mr. Sandusky? We had asked a number of questions, and PCA kindly has given us answers to those questions and put them in your folders this morning, members. I appreciate the answers to your questions. One of the things that when I look at it, you have a number of reports due, feasibility response actions due in April, March and April. And rather than going into your plans about those studies and cleanups now, which are still in process, I think what we will plan on doing is having you back here before the committee shortly after the April 30th date, so that folks can ask questions that you can actually answer. So we will do that. But I did have a couple of notations, and maybe other members would have those too. When you looked at your investigative and response actions being conducted by 3M with your oversight, they all made sense to me until I got to the last one, which was work with, this is 3M is working with PCA to develop surface water criteria standards. It seems to me that it is the state's responsibility to develop those standards and not 3M. So I would ask for, so you can do that in a written response, or you could note that now.
Madam Chair, Mike Sandusky, Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division. I think that's a miswording. I'm glad you pointed that out. It is absolutely our responsibility, and what we have done is we have contracted, because of resources, with an independent outside party to develop those water quality criteria, and the only reference or tangent to 3M would be the use of data that's produced by them in the development of that.
Okay, thank you. We will be looking forward to those standards. And I would just, in terms of the cleanup standards, I think the basic thing that we all will be asking about is groundwater degradation, because your rules say no groundwater degradation, and it seems to me that is our standard. This is our drinking water. And so that is certainly the measure that I will be looking at, just frankly following the law. So that would be something. Two other things I noted in here, that you did not put Pig's Eye down as a spot that you were looking at. If I remember correctly, 3M did dispose things in Pig's Eye, and it seems to me that that should be one of the sites that we look at. And the last thing is, I had questions about monitoring our deep aquifers. So those were my questions. I don't know whether any other members had questions or not about, or want to wait till the April, right after April 30th. Do other members have questions? I don't see other questions. I'm sure that all of us have noted that currently 1,100 pounds of PFCs are being discharged into the Mississippi from the Chemelite plants alone. There is no question that's going to have impact on our fish, and it does no good to give fish advisories on the things that eat our fish besides us. So I think that I noted as an extreme concern. Representative Clark, and then we're going to just ask questions for PCA to follow up in writing on, and then we're going to move really quickly to have folks from the Conservation Corps who came here to testify.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if you could respond, and I don't know which of you should be the proper one to respond, but in your response to Representative Rubinius's questions about the developmental impacts of PFCs that are being examined, your statement here is very different from the statement that Representative Moe read a few minutes ago that said based on from 3M. 3M's statement that based on science there are no health risks from any of the PFCs, PFBA, PFOA, PFOS at levels found in the environment. What you say in your paper, and not everybody here in the public has this, but what you say in response to Representative Bouguinius's questions is Several developmental effects, such as decreased body weight and body weight gain and developmental delays, have been observed in animals treated with PFOS or PFOA. At higher doses, additional developmental delays of decreased viability, altered lung maturation, thyroid hormone changes, and alterations in mammary gland development have also been observed in animals. And then you referenced the cross-sectional study done at Johns Hopkins that associate the PFCs in the cord blood and decreased body weight, head circumference, and length, and that these are statistically significant. So how does a legislator or the public look at those two very different statements and assess them?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I believe the difference is that 3M made their statement based upon the levels found in the environment, and I'll have to call Dr. Solem up here to if we get into this further, but my understanding is those studies are based upon exposures that are much higher than the levels we're talking about in Minnesota.
Okay. So is the difference of one being the levels found in the environment and the other the levels being found in the body? I mean, that's what, in bodies that were studied? Is that what we're talking about here, animals that were studied?
Madam Chair, let me call Dr. Laura Solem up.
Madam Chair, that's fine. I'm happy to hear from them, but I kind of want to know what our own agency is telling us.
Dr. Solem is a member of the outcome staff at the Pollution Control.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Madam Chair, my name is Laura Solem, and I'm a toxicologist with the Pollution Control Agency. Representative Clark, yes, the animal studies, when I refer to them, when I say the higher doses or the effects occur at higher doses, those are doses much higher than what you would find in the environment.
Madam Chair. I think it would be helpful to know what in the environment means, where, and you know, are we talking about in the water, are we talking about in the air, in the ground, I mean, all the different interpretations of what the environment can mean. I guess what comes back to, and I think we're left with the impression based on that first statement that there is absolutely no health risks. It's a very strong statement, and it seems like what's being talked about here is that at some dosages there are health risks.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Clark, if you want to make a direct comparison of the statement that 3M made with the response that we made to the chair, now what you would need first, in my line of reasoning, would be a definition of what 3M used for levels found in the environment, that quote.
Exactly.
I think we can do some of this in written follow-up, and I certainly would appreciate if we could find out what 3M was finding in blood cord. I mean, I know they found it in all but two samples they took. Out of 300, they found it in all but two. What levels they were finding, this is because practically this is what we're looking at. And because they found consequences at those levels. So if you could just share with us, when I was looking at this, I couldn't find that, and that would be helpful if you could do that. And if there are other questions for members, we are going to send them to you in writing. We'll send them by email, and appreciate your complete response as you did for us now. And we will be following up right after April 30th.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. For folks who live in the area, we appreciate your being there. We would like to have folks from the Conservation Corps come up. And I know we are short on time, but what I'd really like to do is hear from as they come up. I believe you brought some students with you, Mr. Price, is that right?
That's correct.
I think let's hear from them. That would be a good way to start off our understanding of the Conservation Corps for those who do not know about it. Oh, I want coffee.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Madam Chair?
Can
I ask you a quick procedural question? Are we going to continue hearing about this bill
Thursday morning? Are we planning to vote on this now?
Well, this bill will be laid over for inclusion.
Okay, thank you.
So we will not be voting on it, but we will be hearing their testimony.
Thank you.
If you're set, please introduce yourself for the tape, and you may begin.
Good morning. My name is Len Price. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservation Corps. And I have to, as an aside, say that the discussion you just had was very interesting to me personally, because in 1989, I was one of the chief authors of the 1989 groundwater bill, and we talked about many of the issues that you are deliberating today. And we made some of those decisions right here in this room. As we put together that landmark legislation. And also, I happen to be a resident of South Washington County, and so I guess I've been consuming many glasses of water in my 30 years that I've lived and worked there, so very interested in this topic. The bill that you have before us, before you today, is a proposal to fund the Minnesota Conservation Corps with the governor's proposed level of funding, and then also with an enhanced amount. And the focus of our presentation today was to try to help you understand why we were asking for the additional money. And I will do that in summation, but in deference to the time that we have a summer corps member who's been in our program for 2 years, a high school student from Rush City, who we'd like to have testify, and then also her mother, who can give you a perspective from the parent's point of view. The materials that we've distributed to you include a note from me, some of the materials that I had offered to you when I came to visit you in your office, and also a report of the kind of work that the Minnesota Conservation Corps has done in your own district. But let's hear from Sarah and her mother first.
Good morning. My name is Sarah. I'm 17 years old. This will hopefully be my third year with the Conservation Corps. I just have to say that it is the best thing that has ever happened to me, and I really enjoy working with the Minnesota Conservation Corps. It's taught me so much about who I am, about life and like work ethics and working with different people, and I'm just really grateful for it, and it's also helped me pick my career path. I would like to join or apply to Stevens Point in Wisconsin and major in Spanish and environmental studies. And yeah, and what else to say?
Thank you, Sarah. Anyone? No questions for Sarah? If we can proceed.
Can you guys hear me? I'm Adrienne Warren and Sarah's mom. I currently live in St. Louis Park, and fortunately I've had two daughters go through the Conservation Corps program. First daughter went back in 96 for one summer, and like Len and Sarah said, for 2 years now. I am a firm believer in the program. It helped both of our daughters grow as young women, as employed individuals. They also came back with a lot of knowledge of our natural resources, of our state parks. They played a part in beautifying our state parks. I don't know how many of you here in this room have visited any of our state parks. I have pretty much all of them and will continue to do so. As I walk through the boardwalks that keep my feet dry, keep the plants and everything else underneath, free of our harm, I look around and just absolutely enjoy what I see. And once I found out that MCC played a part in this, I took a little pride in that, even though I wasn't the one sweating, I wasn't the one fighting off the bugs. I took pride that my two daughters played a part somehow in making parks beautiful for everyone to visit, not just Minnesotans, but anyone who comes through to our parks. I am, like I said, I back this program up 100% for all inner city and greater Minnesota teens. I do have a 7-year-old granddaughter. In 8 years, I will be right there with her going through the application process, hopefully, at the Minnesota Conservation Corps, still growing strong by that time. I believe in it that much. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any comments, questions?
Chair.
Representative Dill.
Thank you. Members, in my previous legislative terms and serving as vice chair of this committee under Representative Osment, I encouraged Representative Osment to do everything possible in our budget for this organization. I have traveled around this, at least the northern part of the state, from the west to the east, Representative Moe's district, Representative Pence's district, formerly all over my district, and others, Representative Howe's. And these folks, we get the best bang for the buck of about anything I have ever seen in this state. I mean, and we've got a lot of good things that go on in this state. I would really encourage Chair Wagenius and this committee to consider the request that they have before us to the best of our possible ability. I've been and met at a gas station over in just to the west of Bemidji, and I ran into a crew, and they were so covered with bugs and dirt and dust, they were happy, and they were happy. And it was a lot of kids. And I know that I just recently went on a trail that they improved in such good work. So, Senator Price and Rolf, thank you for your work, and I would really encourage us to take a very strong look at this. I know they took a real shellacking in those tough budget years we had. Not that any time isn't tough, but my encouragement would be for that. So thank you for the opportunity to share that with you.
Thank you. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I just need to concur with Representative Dill. I have some personal experience with the Minnesota Conservation Corps. Craig Aiken was the regional director in northwestern Minnesota. In my position at Bemidji State University, we contracted them with them for some much-needed work at Hobson Forest, our university forest. Those facilities are still strong and standing and working well, and I can't imagine, just like Representative Bill said, that we could come up with anything that would be more productive for our state tax dollars, because we're putting young people to work, doing work that we couldn't do ourselves for anywhere near the price that we're getting it done for, or the quality. So, yes, Madam Chair, I hope we can find the resources in tight times to support this.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for those nice comments, but we actually, I think, have to move the bill before we run out of time, and so if somebody could help me with that.
I'll move that.
Representative Dill moves House File 538.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill puts back to historic levels what the Minnesota Conservation Corps has provided in the packet, and has moved through the Senate with support of Senator Bach, and hopefully in my conversations with Chair Wagenius, so we can get up to the highest amount level, full funding for this request, and so they can address what is also a backlog of work groups would appreciate, that the Corps could come and help them with their projects. I know that I spent 3 years with the Forest Service in the middle 1990s, and restoring channels and doing hydrology and such, and there were days when running field crews that we'd be charged with moving lots of rocks and picking up lots of heavy logs and things like that, but those were the days when the Montana Conservation Corps would come and help us. So we had core days, is what we call them, and we certainly got a lot more done those days when the Conservation Corps members came to help us. So, they can leverage $2 for every dollar that we give them. There's good support with this bill from leadership. Representative Sertich thinks this is a priority, and I hope that for possible inclusion in this committee's finance bill, we can maximize the effort and put people who are young into the outdoors who might want to, I guess, be involved with environmental and natural resource management, but realizing that I'm from a generation that too many have slipped through the cracks and they don't have any field experience. They don't know how to measure a fish. They don't know, how to engineer or even do a survey of a cross-section for a channel. Just basic engineering skills and running a saw or using an axe or, knowing how to behave to go get your environmental measurements so you can actually have some authority on what your environmental opinion is. Without field experience, we suffer the risk of having whole generations not know anything about land and our connection to it. So this is an early on way for youth to be connected to Minnesota's outdoor heritage and environment and natural resources pride, if you will. And I'm hoping that everybody in the committee can find it to support this request fully.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Any questions for our testifier?
No, Chair.
Representative Dale.
Well, I have. When I was in at my local high school in Orr, I asked a question. We were talking about these very things, and I asked one of the fifth grade class what a rod was, and they all basically said it was a steel piece of rebar. And if you ask the Conservation Corps members what a rod is, they'll tell you how many feet that is. So, I think your point is well made on that.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to express my support for this program as well, having spent many hours in reading lots of papers to write a master's thesis about basically what your program does. I'm just wondering if you do any sort of studies of outcomes or could point me to particular ones about what the Corps does. I've read enough of the theoretical stuff in various other papers and other places, but I'm wondering if there's any specific to Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Knuth, we belong to a national organization which has just recently changed its name to the Corps Network. It used to be referred to as NASC, and they have commissioned a study of all corps in the United States to illustrate the benefits that you are referencing to the individuals that are involved in these corps. And that report will be forthcoming and given to the Corporation for National and Community Service, which is the funder of AmeriCorps in the United States. We are participating in that program and that study.
Representative Wiggins. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you brought your original stuff to us, you had outcomes better than anybody else has done this year, and I commend you on that, because what we have been asking for is outcomes, and you certainly provided those. Since this is the Money Committee, tell us what the Governor has put in his budget and what you are requesting, if you could. Perhaps that's a question for Representative Peterson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Representative Beginnings. I believe that it's correct to say the Governor is at $840,000. Per year.
And you are requesting?
We are asking, it's a little complicated as to what fund. So currently there are $350,000, I believe, from the general fund, and $250,000 has been added into the general fund request for this year, but taking that from the dedicated natural resource fund. But they're asking for, so if you strip that out, you're asking for $1.2 million more is the request. Maybe Mr. Price could justify why that number is what it is.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Genius, each dollar that we're able to get in what I like to call venture capital, which would be the state funding, we can use to match the AmeriCorps grant that we're pursuing which indeed is much larger than the one that we currently are engaged in. And then we can take those, that $1 of state funding and go out and find two other dollars to run our program. And we've been successful in doing that since we became a 501c3 nonprofit. 50% of our operating budget monies come from fee for service. That's the charge that we assess to the project partners that we do business with. And that system seems to work quite well. So the more dollars that we can get from the state, the more we can go out and leverage, and really the more core members that we can put on the field, in the field, to have this experience. And to have an opportunity in the AmeriCorps program to be eligible to receive an AmeriCorps Education Award, which is currently worth $4,725 after a year of service.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Any further questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, we did have a PowerPoint presentation, and what we'll do is send it to your staff, and then you can have it available. It articulated many more things that we wanted to bring up, like the firefighting component that we provide for the state and other things that would help solidify our request.
Thank you.
So we will make that.
Mr. Chair,
we'll appreciate that.
I'd renew my motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Dill.
We don't have to vote on that.
But on that, the bill is laid over for consideration. Any further business before the committee today? If not, we're adjourned.